Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Why is the South Dakota Democratic Party closing offices in Rapid City and Sioux Falls? What's the latest on the proposed uranium mine near Edgemont? And what is former Sioux Falls Mayor Mike Huther's big announcement this afternoon? We're about to run these questions by the Dakota Political Junkies. Rapid City Journal Enterprise reporter Seth Tupper joins us from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Rapid City space. Hey, Seth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And John Schaff is professor of political science at Northern State University, and he's joining us from the Tom and Danielle Ammon Foundation studio in Aberdeen. Hi, John.
Hey, good to be here.
All right, Seth, let's start with the Democrats, and let's start with you, because this is a story that you've been looking into for some time. You broke this earlier in the month. Now we're hearing that they are closing their offices in Sioux Falls and Rapid City to save some money. How did we get here?
Well, if you go back to statehood, no. Democrats have had a hard time in South Dakota historically.
Right.
But no, most recently, I caught on to a story. I don't know how long it's been now, but just a month or so that the state Democratic Party had been audited by the Federal Elections Commission. And it was not a great audit. They were flagged for a number of things that they either failed to report or reported incorrectly. And on top of all that, their most recently filed report said they only had $3,000 and some odd on hand. And in the wake of all that, now, as you mentioned, we've heard that the Democrats are closing their offices in Sioux Falls and Rapid City. And it's been really interesting to watch the reaction to that, because it is a very symbolic attention-getting thing when a state party closes offices in the two biggest cities. But if, you know, anybody who's familiar with politics in South Dakota and has been following it realizes that, you know, this has been something that, you know, maybe was coming for a long time, and the Democratic Party has been really downtrodden, really, for the last 10 or 12 years since Stephanie Hirsa-Sandlin was defeated by Kristi Noem, and since Tim Johnson retired from the U.S. Senate. They've never really recovered from that, and it's been sort of a long, gradual decline. And, you know, it's really not surprising that they've had some hard times, and although it is obviously quite, you know, attention-getting when they have to do something as drastic as closing their offices.
So at this point, staff is going to work, remotely. But Seth, I want to get at this idea of it's not just that they're running out of money because people haven't donated. It's also that there's these financial irregularities. And last week we talked a little bit about the money that passed through the National Committee, through South Dakota, and then on into other candidates. But there are also some other problems that this draft audit from the FEC pointed out. Real irregularities here. That's not just a small thing.
Yeah, just, I mean, it. When you look at it, it just kind of points to perhaps mismanagement, or somebody wasn't paying close enough attention, or incompetence, I don't know what. But it has been interesting to watch, you know, the statements coming out of the new leadership of the party, which, you know, both of the chair of the party, Paula Hawks, and the executive director, Stacey Burnett, are both, you know, relatively new and weren't in office when these problems occurred during the period covered by the audit. But they've been, you know, passing blame, really, in their public statements to the previous administration. And so, you know, you not only have the financial problems, the mess, the audit, which, you know, still isn't completely settled with the FEC. Now you have current administration blaming past administration. And, you know, just about the last thing the party needs right now is division when they're going to facing a situation where they have to, you know, raise money just to have an office. So it's not a great look. And it's certainly, you know, for a party that, you know, has had trouble historically, but has had, you know, moments of success, it's certainly one of the historic low points, I would say, for the party right now.
Seth, before we go on to ask John Schaff about that historic low point, it's important to point out that the state or the Democratic Party treasurer is still the same as before. So as Paula Hawks and others point to previous administration, they really still have the same person who is arguably in charge of that money working for them today.
That is true. And as we've seen, that's something that the Republicans have pounced on and pointed that out. State Republican Party has been having great fun pointing out all the foibles of the Democratic Party right now, and that's politics. But yeah, I don't know what'll come out of this, and I would assume, you know, there's already been quite a bit of leadership change within the party, and maybe we'll see even more going forward.
All right, John Schaaf, sort of a historic moment, the optics of this. Talk a little bit about what this means for the statewide party and really for the Republican Party as well.
Well, I think as Seth is intimating, this is a continuation of this process that, amongst all the other problems, the electoral problems that the Democrats have in the state, is they seem to have these administrative problems. Remember at their convention last year where they had to redo their convention, they had to come back into session because they failed to follow proper procedures in nominating officials for statewide offices. You know, and then when you get this report saying you also have, so it's like misapplication of money or really bad financial stewardship, it begins to look like it's kind of the gang that couldn't shoot straight. And so they have a hard enough time in our state putting forth candidates that are attractive to a majority of voters simply because of where, you know, partisan registration is. But when on top of that, you have these deep organizational problems, it creates problems where your ability to mobilize voters, your ability to reach out to new voters, your ability simply to put together a workable structure that when there is an opportunity, you can take advantage of the opportunity, both, you know, organizationally and then financially, the party can't seem to get its act together. And that ends up putting the Democrats in an even worse position than they would otherwise. And as Seth indicates, I mean, it's not like the Democrats put up a lot of fight anyway, but the Republicans are having a lot of fun with this. And it's just they can see that their position is even more firmly ensconced because the opposition, the Democrats, are unable to put together even a mildly competent alternative to the Republican Party.
Seth, what's the way forward on this? And before we ask that question, our conversation about former Sioux Falls Mayor Mike Huether comes to mind because he was a Democrat who left the party. Do you think there's also a risk of losing, you know, what could be a really viable candidate because somebody doesn't want to be associated with this party? What do you think, Seth?
Certainly, yeah. And as a way forward, I don't know. Certainly you'd think Billy Sutton had something going on in the 2018 cycle where he came very close to becoming the first Democratic governor in an awfully long time in South Dakota. So, you know, I guess if I were a Democrat, I would be thinking, perhaps there's something that Billy Sutton knows or that we need to tap into. I mean, there was certainly an example to follow there for the party. Right. But when you go beyond that, the candidate bench is pretty thin. The money is thin. It's rough. I should say, this is not an aberration. Historically, when George McGovern became the executive secretary of the state Democratic Party in the 50s or 60s, the party was at a terrible low point then too and had to be rebuilt almost from nothing. And so it has happened before, and that's so, they certainly could rebuild the party again with the right leadership. There are still, I don't know that having the numbers on hand, but there are, hundreds of thousands of Democrats in South Dakota still, so it's not as though there's nothing to build with. It's just a matter of probably getting the right people in place and the right plan and catching fire with a candidate or two.
So, Seth, knowing that what we know today about the functions administratively of the party and then looking back at that election with Billy Sutton and current Governor Kristi Noem, is it even more impressive that Billy did as well as that he did if there was really no firm foundation under him?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it was amazing when you look at what the registration numbers were, what the lack of organization was, with the lack of other candidates on the ballot that maybe could have drawn, good Democrats out. I think it was an incredible achievement for Billy Sutton to do as well as he did, because he had even bigger hurdles than past Democrats who've come close or won in South Dakota.
John Schaaf, you have thoughts on how to move forward with this party? I mean, what kind of gutting needs to happen? What kind of, what would satisfy? Obviously, and we're not going to have the final audit because of the lack of quorum in the FEC right now. So this could drag on for some time as well.
Yeah, well, I think what Seth was just saying, what you're asking about Billy Sutton, it sort of indicates the problem that the Democratic Party has. you know, basically what we're saying with Billy Sutton is that it was a great moral victory. Well, there's another name for a moral victory. That's called a loss. this is what I'm talking about, is that the Sutton versus Noem race was a race that the Democrats could have won because all the stars were aligned. They had the right candidate at the right time. But there is simply not the organization. Billy Sutton was essentially on his own in a relatively close race, trying to put together an organization and a get out the vote organization in order to get over the top, whereas Kristi Noem could depend on a well-financed, well-organized, well-run organization in addition to her own campaign to get her voters out to vote. And that's what is the problem with the Democratic Party. And I don't know what the solution would be other than you need probably someone like a George McGovern-esque character, as well as probably at least a handful of people who are willing to finance someone like that and to start from the ground up. You know, they've had some help from the National Party. Tim Johnson was slowly defunding his own campaign account by kind of dribbling out to the state party. I don't know how much money that's left, probably not a ton. But at a certain point, they've got to be self-sufficient and be able to raise money and to get on their own and get together an organization on their own, or they're going to have a series of moral victories.
All right, let's switch subjects here and talk a little bit about a controversial program from the state of South Dakota about CAFOs, or these hog confinement or animal confinement operations. And Seth, explain this to us a little bit, because this is the state essentially putting their fingers on the scales, trying to provide incentives. Other people have a different word for incentives and how they see it. Explain, please.
Yeah, it's incentives versus bribery, basically. That's what it boils down to, according to, depending on your perspective. But the state put out a news release in May, the Governor's Office of Economic Development announcing that they were going to take some existing economic development programs that have been used to rebate sales taxes paid on newer expanding business construction in South Dakota. And they developed special terms in those programs for concentrated animal feeding operations, like hog confinements, cattle feedlots, et cetera, whereby if the builders of those CAFOs, as they're called, agreed to give their sales tax rebates to the counties where the projects are located, to the county governments, then they could have access to this program. And essentially, it depends. So the state is essentially saying to counties, if you approve conditional use permits, zoning permits for these projects, then you can get the sales tax rebates on these projects that would otherwise go to the builders of those projects. And in Hand County is a really interesting case because the state has written a letter to that a project developer there who wants to build a 9,000-head hog facility that the sales tax rebate could be up to somewhere around $477,000 if the developer of that project agrees to give that rebate to Hand County and if Hand County approves the permit. And so you have Little Hand County right now with the county seat of Miller has like a $3 million general fund budget for county government, and they're weighing this conditional use permit at the same time as the elephant in the room, one commissioner said, is this $477,000 potential windfall that could come if they approve the permit. And on the other side, you have people that don't like CAFOs and think that they're, in some cases, bad for the environment and concerned about the odors and different things. And so it's a really interesting case of state government, some would say, intruding or at least inserting themselves into local decisions and really having a big influence.
Hmm. John Schaff, what's the difference between an incentive and a bribe?
Well, you stole the metaphor I was gonna make. And this is, you know, it's always whenever the government acts to promote a certain kind of industry, there's always the question of where is the line between economic development and simply funneling money, if you want to call it a bribe, or even perhaps less nefarious, perhaps maybe just some nest lining, put it that way. And this is difficult to adjudicate which is which, because what we're talking about with the CAFOs is something that would probably produce a certain amount of wealth, would give another alternative for South Dakota agriculture, another place to go, another kind of ag business to run. But recognizing, as Seth indicates, that there are problems with this mass confinement of animals and environmental disease, this sort of thing, you need to pay people. But you'd say, what's the difference between incentivizing people to start CAFOs and incentivizing people to build wind turbines? Right. You know, in both cases, you're taking money from the public to give to a very defined segment of the economy because you think there's some sort of public benefit, which means you are going to take public money to give to a private entity, which will then turn around and try to make profit out of it. And so is that bribery or is that economic stimulation? And I'll leave that up to listeners to figure out, because obviously it will depend on each individual instance which one that is.
Right. And Seth, you mentioned in your piece in the Rapid City Journal, and folks can find Seth's work at rapidcityjournal.com, that some of the commissioners were saying, you know, this has also created a problem for us, because if we vote, no on this CAFO, then people are going to accuse us of really missing an opportunity for all this windfall. But if we vote yes, people are going to say that we were bought out or we were convinced solely on the merits of the money that was coming in on the rebate. And they won't necessarily even believe that we are looking at the CAFO itself and deciding that it is good or not good for our community.
Yeah, exactly. It just puts, you know, the county commissioners in a tough spot. And, you know, any county commissioner you talk to, I'm sure will say, as the one I talked to from Hand County said, you know, I'm just going to consider this application for this CAFO on its merits. I'm not going to let the prospect of a sales tax rebate windfall influence me. But obviously, you know, it creates the appearance of a conflict, whether there is one or not. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it real tough for commissioners is they're kind of damned if they do, damned if they don't.
What do you see happening in the future on this, Seth? Is it going to be a county by county, operation by operation discussion? It's going to kind of, I don't want to say wreak havoc, but it's going to change the conversation for all of these?
Yeah, I really do, because yeah. They rolled the program out in May, and there's already been four. The state has already approved from its end at least four applications to this program. And so I would suspect that you'll see more and more of those pop up. The question is, you know, the people that oppose this program, Dakota Rural Action, you know, people out who are opponents of these individual projects, are how far are they going to take their activism on this, and could it possibly then become an issue in the next legislative session? Mm. We'll have to see what happens there.
All right. Speaking of something else that continues to be a topic of conversation, uranium mining and hearings according, relations with the tribes, all kinds of things that Seth Tupper has been covering at rapidcityjournal.com. Let's talk about what the latest is on this. What sort of hearings are we seeing this week, Seth?
Yeah, well, we saw they were last week.
Last week.
Then there's more hearings coming up. But your listeners might have deja vu on this. This is something that this proposed uranium mine near Edgemont has been in the proposal stage for more than a decade now. As the project manager down there for the company that's proposing the project likes to call it, he says it's regulatory purgatory. It was one of his favorite lines. But anyway, what's kind of at issue now is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, back I believe in 2009, it was granted this project a license, even though at the time the NRC acknowledged that there was this outstanding contention over the fact that there hadn't been an adequate survey of the project area to determine if there might be any Native American archaeological remains or burial sites or places of cultural historical importance in the project area. And so that now has been litigated, and it's been back and forth into court and out of court and batted around by the NRC and the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board with no final resolution. And they conducted more hearings about that last week here in Rapid City. There's not a decision scheduled until November from the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, but they're trying to determine basically has the government and the project proponent done enough to study this issue of Native American cultural resources in the project area, or have they not? And it's all based on requirements from the from NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. And so that's what we're waiting for. And it's a key thing because all the other permits that this project needs, the state, federal, and local level, are kind of waiting on this NRC process to play out. And, you know, here we are a decade into that, and there's still no resolution. Mm.
And John Schaff, as you sort of read the subtext of how these groups sort of refer to each other about the Cultural Resources Survey, you really hear the project leaders saying, yeah, the tribe just won't show up, they won't cooperate. You can almost predict what they're going to say. And the tribe says, yeah, you haven't done your job yet. We can't protect what we can't see. We need to know. It's going to be too late. We've heard those arguments before.
Yeah, because it sounds a lot like what happened at Standing Rock, if that's what you're referring to. And so this is, you know, it's a problem that we have with any kind of these projects is that we have these tensions and that we want to protect. We're just talking about the confined agriculture, the hogs, cattle. We want to protect the environment, but we also, you know, people want to do business. In this case, there's a mine that we want to put in, or someone wants to put in. To, you know, make money, it would probably stimulate the economy, the Edgemont area, do all sorts of good things. But then there are all these other concerns. And so we're trying to balance environmental concerns. In this case, there's a cultural concern with the mine, with having a, you know, how long a process do you want this to be? And the way regulations are, especially on federal projects, anything that the federal government gets into is that it takes years upon years. You know, people like to point out that a project like the Hoover Dam from conception to end took place in about 2 years. And now, you know, we can't build a bridge in some cases or okay a mine here. It's been a decade in the process. You know, how much deference do you want to give to regulatory agencies to over and over and over review these things? But it's precisely because we have a competition of interests, we want to make sure that everybody's interests are involved, and that can take an awful long time.
Right. And Seth, from the tribal perspective, what are you hearing them say as far as they articulating, you know, that time is meaningless in some ways because it could be all, if you make the wrong decision here, you can't undo it. What else is the tribe sort of saying? Are you hearing why this might be a cultural site? Tell us a little bit about its location in relation to history.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's at the southwestern edge of the Black Hills. And, of course, as a lot of people know, the Black Hills are an important part of the spirituality of Sioux Native Americans and other Native American tribes. And it was once, this area was once part of the much broader Great Sioux Reservation, which encompassed all of western South Dakota. And so, and there are some, from a literature review, it's known that there are some archaeological sites out in that project area, but that's the point, is that, you know, they need to know more before they start digging. And from the Native American perspective, you know, they're informed by a lot of historical wrongs, and they're feeling that, you know, the government historically hasn't done a great job of consulting with tribes on things like this and protecting tribal interests. And so there seems to be a view that, you know, they really want to assert their rights in as full a way as they possibly can on this issue before it's too late. And, of course, from the other side, the company is arguing Uranium and its subsidiary PowerTech, which is proposing the mine. They're alleging that the tribe just has an opposition to the mine itself and don't want to see it built, and therefore are using these concerns about the Cultural Resources Survey as a stalling tactic. And that's what's being constantly batted back and forth right now between the two sides.
And Seth, John mentioned Standing Rock. Or what sort of protests are we seeing, or what sort of conversations in the meeting are they? Is it subdued? Is it sort of noisy? How did you characterize some of the hearings?
Well, that was what was interesting. I forget. I had it in my story, I think, four or five times. There's been hearings on this project in Rapid City. Now this was the latest one. At previous hearings, there was the public was allowed to participate if you signed up to be a speaker, and there were lots of sign waving and even shouting and chanting and very boisterous meetings. This one last week in Rapid City was limited to just the officially involved participants, and so it was very staid and very calm. There were people in the audience who were there to listen, but it was very, very low key. There's another hearing planned in October in Hot Springs that the EPA is conducting, which probably will be more boisterous because that's a hearing specifically to gather public input on the project.
All right. You can read more at rapidcityjournal.com. Seth Tupper, enterprise reporter for the Journal. Thanks so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
John Schaff is professor of political science at Northern State. Dr. Schaff, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.